Venetia Welby, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Please tell me about your debut novel, which is a bit of a tour de force, I felt. I felt it sucked me in and spat me out.
Well, that makes me enormously happy if you enjoy being spat out.
I do.
That's entirely positive. Anyway, yeah, it is my first novel. It's the story of a lost soul, Matty Karani. He's lost everything and everyone he's ever cared about. And it seems as if his life is over before it's really begun. He's trapped in a cycle of self-destruction, living in the past, and there's nothing really left for him except for the fleeting pleasures he uses to try to escape himself and reality. And this is a journey that takes him to some dark places, both dark places of London's Soho and dark corners of his own splintering psyche.
Yes, it covers a lot. And as you say, the title of the book is Mother of Darkness.
Yes. That was actually a suggestion of the publishers, which I was very grateful for. It wasn't that originally, but the title speaks to a number of things. There's the mother complex at the heart of the novel. So Matty's mother died giving birth to him, and he's looking for maternal love in all the wrong places. So there's darkness where there should be the light and safety of a mother, and Matty himself is darkness. You know, he's doom, despair, depression, all those dark things that lurk in the unslept night. And yeah, so it's also a nod to the Conrad novella Heart of Darkness, one man's journey into the unknown following a godlike figure.
Yes. So there's so many things. One, there's just the the scourge of gentrification of Soho. That is a theme that goes through it. Kind of fun.
I desperately wanted to draw attention to that as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, every time I go there, there's another crane. There's another beloved building torn down. There's,
crane, another chain.
Yeah, another hard hat. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ferrick Street Market fighting for its life. Mm-hmm. Crossrail threatening Curzon, Soho, and just all these amazing, iconic places. And Walker's Court was the last one to go down in rubble.
I've lived through sort of Giuliani sanitizing New York and had a very similar, the seamy underbelly, throbbing heart.
That's where the character is.
Character being ripped out and sanitized and Disneyfied.
It's very sad.
Which is, I suppose, how you, like everyone else, has been pushed east.
Pushed east, but how much further can we go?
France.
Yes. Some have gone to Poland, some friends of mine.
Right.
It is a relentless march, gentrification, and on it goes. And actually, it's not just England, it's not just the UK. The research I've been doing for a book I'm writing about Spain has left me horrified as I've realised these beautiful ancient squares are just a giant McDonald's. I thought they were sort of beautiful pavement cafes with all the sort of romance of European cafe culture, but no, it's McDonald's, Starbucks, Costa.
Yes.
It is very sad.
Yes. But before we could go down that tunnel for a while, and that is sort of a tangential backdrop of the book, and sort of a mirror of Matty's own black hole.
Disintegration.
Disintegration and sort of taking everything in his vacuum.
Absolutely. And I suppose it also it mirrors his nostalgia for everything. He's unable to see the present clearly. He's unable to deal with reality, so he lives in the past, wherever that might be. And that involves romanticizing Soho equally.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the form of the book. There were a lot of interesting, there's a lot of meaty stuff in there, so it's going to take a little bit to unpick, and I also don't want to give away the revealing stories as they unfold.
Yeah, I think that's sensible.
Yes, I think it's important to leave that intact for the readers. So we start out with Maddie going to therapy.
Yes, persuaded by his terrible stepmother. Finally, he decides it might be a good idea.
So the form, and she encourages him to sort of, there's life writing therapy.
Yes.
So that we get, there's a lot of different types of writing in the book.
Mm.
And some of it is his writing, some of it is his own narrated story,
mm-hmm.
Of which he is a wildly unreliable narrator.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's the only reason he agrees to do his homework, yes, for the psychiatrist.
Yes, that he gets to be
the architect of his own fortune.
Yes.
Or lack thereof.
And there's one of the things we get to see is the therapist's take on what he presents to her.
Mm.
And something very interesting, because the whole idea of identity and identity, autonomy are very bound up with him and very lost with him.
Mm.
And there was this concept that I hadn't heard of dysnarrativia.
Right, yes.
Fascinating.
That if you can't write your own story, if you can't relate to your own story, then your identity is fragmented. I looked into that quite a lot, actually, in a comparative literature degree. The idea of creating a self by stringing together your own life, by writing your own life. I looked at it particularly with Sylvia Plath, actually, and The Bell Jar, and the fragments of Sappho. This idea that in the absence of a solid sense of self, you can create an artificial one. And I think it's very much in the spirit of creativity. I think a lot of creative people sort of have a slightly splintered identity, and they want to kind of lock it down and create paths that can be tangible and look mm-hmm. back upon and also examined. You know, it must be quite reassuring to people who've written a diary in their youth to be able to look back on it and see some sort of continuity between how they are now and how they were then. I didn't write a diary, so I have no idea.
But yeah, and also to me, that strikes every society, culture, nation, family, person has their own creation myth.
Yeah, and so much more with social media now. Everyone is only as good as their last photograph,
mm-hmm.
Or the last, you know, witty status update. Mm. It's a constant rolling steamroller of self-creation.
Mm. And if there are gaps in that, then there, you know, this idea that there's a correlative gap in your identity, that you're not living, you're not being.
Well, and particularly for people who can't understand why they behaved the way they did,
mm-hmm.
that is another, that would be a draw for trying to string all the disparate events of your life mm-hmm. together.
As well as the addict's sort of, is this all there is?
Yes, and also the view. Addict's the addict's inevitable memory loss and mm-hmm. holes in and, mm-hmm. And warped behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
That can't be rationalized in the cold light of day until it can be made sense of in the sort of life as a whole.
And talking of creation myths brings me to another aspect of the form of the book, is Greek myths.
Yes.
And one which is very close to my heart, because I studied it very closely and I do relate it to everyday life, is the Oresteia.
Right.
And Orestes, who, you know, forcibly, you know, encouraged to kill his mother because social codes demanded it. But then, of course, matricide is punished by the Furies.
Yes.
And then it results in the first civic trial we have known, and Athena decides. Old gods, new gods, all kinds of things in there. What role for you do those, our earliest myths, what role do they have for you? What role do they have for you in the book?
Well, I think they're so psychologically rich. I mean, it's no coincidence that Jung and Freud went straight for those myths when they were trying to unpick, you know, the human psyche. I love that they're so gritty. They're so raw. They're not afraid of exploring the shadow side of humanity and all those dirty emotions that we kick under the table because they're not acceptable. They aim, and the Oresteia in particular does wonders for guilt, murder, that sort of thing.
Lust.
Yeah, pretty much everything. Mm. They deal with the taboo. And I wanted to deal with the taboo as well. I wanted to man up, woman up, and not be afraid of taking on these dark subjects, even though I feared a publisher might think twice before taking on such material.
Hmm. And another of the myths and gods you invite into the book is Bacchus.
Yes.
And he is the very embodiment of the dark, the mad.
Yes, but also the fun.
The fun.
You know,
yes.
he is everything Matty wants life to be.
A mad merry dance.
Yes, yes, exactly. And in many ways he's like Matty's friend Fix. Chaotic. And I mean, I think a large part of the Bacchae is pointing out that life has two sides. You can't just be the light, there is also the dark. You can't just be the person who works all day, you must also be the one who goes out and makes merry. And that is a philosophy that suits Matty very well, given that his life is in tatters and all he can do is go out and have fun, or try to have fun. It's not exactly the most fun anyone can have, I believe.
No. Yes, well, and his philosophy is, why wouldn't you try everything that there is?
Yes, yes.
Although he doesn't seem to be trying, it's very funny because it is a philosophy that it is easy to be bound up in, but he's only trying the one side of it.
He's never trying
the sort of disciplined, you know.
But he's very good at justifying
his
behavior.
Mm.
That is part of writing one's own narrative.
Mm.
You call on the gods or the primal forces, if you want, not gods necessarily. I mean, that's what the myths serve, isn't it? They are embodiments of things that are within us. So he calls on those things that justify his behaviour.
Hmm. Yes, it's if something is preordained and bigger than us, then I'm clearly not responsible for it.
Right, right. And this leads into the whole thing that made me want to write the book in the first place, which was wondering how people do start cults and religions, and how do they get written, these myths, and well, not myths so much as, I mean, creation myths and religious stories. What is it that makes someone feel like they are a messiah, or that they are a cult leader, they are a guru? How does it start? Where does it come from? Where can it end? These were the questions I wanted to look into.
I have to say, I felt that that fueled existence and all of those voices that bubble up around the aftermath of a night out. Been doing a lot of thinking about that recently, and it's that, you know, when people say, oh, I'm really hungover, it's like, well, that was part of the whole experience,
right?
It's not separate.
Yes.
It's not an aftermath, it's part. If you take one, you take the other. It is a rolling,
which is the reality again.
Yes. And then the messianic comes in with the very destabilizing effects of having continually done this.
Yes.
And the pile up of consequences while you were doing that.
Yes.
You know, that is, it is like a snowballing.
Yes, the unleashing of the various personalities within him, which are given mm-hmm. voice by these very unstable states he continually puts himself into.
Yeah.
You know, he's pretty unstable anyway. As his psychotherapist goes to great trouble to point out,
yes.
a host of personality disorders to begin with.
Mm. And the one that's expressed in Latin, puer eternus.
Yes.
As I just started studying Latin, I was like, oh, eternal boy. I get it.
Good work.
Yes. But that struck me as probably, just looking at it from the outside, you mentioned social media and the all of the forces of gentrification and change and feeling, we do seem to have this ramping up feeling, true or imagined at the moment.
Of heading towards the apocalypse.
Yeah, there's that too, yes.
I certainly sometimes feel that this is...
Oh yes, the four horsemen are on the horizon.
Yeah.
Nero is tuning up his fiddle, you know, as we speak, absolutely. But also with this prevalent in him, I would say, what's the genesis of his disaster? Was it birth? Was it whatever? But earlier you can see the signs of someone sort of wanting to be a YouTube, you know, thinking that by playing video games, I will be a YouTube sensation. Sort of bypassing, there's somehow this step of like, my genius will be recognized for doing zero.
Yeah. Absolutely, and this is a sort of stock characteristic of the puer eternus, this archetype, this idea that you are special, you are gifted, and that you're always sort of waiting in the wings for your moment, and that could be starting a cult, it could be rising to stardom as some incredible actress, it could be becoming president of the United States. I don't want to go too far into that, but...
But that is also something, it struck me as something that is probably going to be, or is, maybe almost an epidemic of that with our culture of, you know, like anything you do is great and we are all special and you're special. And,
yeah.
You know.
Well, it comes from, it's interesting, isn't it? It comes from individuality, mm-hmm. the sense that the individual yes. can do anything. And yet, individuality is what we're wiping out in towns and cities across the country.
We are and we're not. There's sort of a cult of it, but it's like The Life of Brian. We are all individuals.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
You know, it's there's an intensity to that.
A responsibility as well.
Mm.
Too much choice, maybe, if you can do anything. If you really are special and gifted, then... You know, the whole world is open to you. That's a fairly daunting prospect.
Yes. Speaking of worlds being open to you, Maddie does come from a life of perceived privilege.
Yes.
But then that is, and I think that's also it's a book I felt very much of our time, and. As you can hear, I'm American,
mm-hmm.
and I understand you've lived in many different places. Could you tell me a little
traveled,
bit about your...
I've traveled in many different places, most notably an attempted emigration to Beijing when I realised that renting a London flat and trying to write a novel and being a private tutor and editing just wasn't working. It was all too expensive. So I moved to Beijing, where everything seemed to be more expensive, so I eventually moved back. But certainly my time in Beijing and also travelling in China a few years earlier, I had a great friend at university who studied Chinese and part of her degree was spent out there. So we had exciting travels, flying into Beijing and out of Hong Kong and visiting as many places as we could via 40-hour train journeys on the way down. When I lived in Beijing, it was... as cheaply as I possibly could, in a bedsit in the old Bar District, which is actually rather like Soho. But even then, sort of buildings and whole streets were being demolished overnight and then shiny new ones were going up. So I did feel then, as I do now, like the apocalypse was perhaps approaching. So certainly my time in China helped to inform writing about Matty's nomadic childhood. as did time spent in Havana, Cuba, where I've also lived or attempted to. traveling is the thing I love most in the world.
And what's your path to writing been?
It's been pretty constant since I was able to pick up a pen. The first evidence of it was a puppy training manual, which I believe one day will be noted for its brilliance and usefulness, but remains unpublished, alas. But I've written stories pretty much all my life. I thought it would be a clever idea to go into magazine journalism as a way of getting paid and writing. But I realised that nobody in the offices actually did write. It was all farmed out to freelance writers, and I was just too chaotic for office work. I was constantly in trouble. My desk was a mess. I couldn't do the filing. I couldn't work the computer. So, yeah,